you very much, Mr. Wolf. It's a pleasure to be here with you and with Raymond Cohen and with my friend Desmond Travers, who has kindly allowed himself to be drafted onto the panel. And yes, we'll also be speaking, I'll give an advertisement for this, later this week at Harvard University for 6 p.m. on Thursday at the Center for International Affairs, if you're interested. He's a very fine speaker, you'll hear. And our last speaker, Raymond Cohen, is also a very fine, eloquent speaker. And I find myself agreeing with many, indeed, almost all of the comments that he's made. So what I want to do is to recraft some of the things that I was going to say so that we don't have too much duplication. And I want to begin by taking us back a little bit. If we could turn back the clock to the 1990s, to the early 1990s. It was following the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait and the successful expulsion of Iraq from Kuwait by a coalition force led by the U.S. It was a period of remarkable hope. I remember during that period, I was writing a fair amount on, sort of what next questions. And I remember participating as a consultant and an advisor in discussions in Washington and places like the Y Plantation outside of Washington with administration officials in the first Bush administration. And the question is, what kind of a peace project should there be? And some of the old-time politicians, much persuaded by the model of Kissinger's step-by-step diplomacy, argued for a very incremental approach. And others argued for a much more ambitious approach, modeled in some ways on the experience of Europe's transformation and the Annus Mirabilis, the miracle year of 1989, an approach which emphasized not just addressing the Arab-Israeli conflict, but many of the other problems in the region, question of refugees broadly considered, economic development, water, security, and so on, and the environment as well. And what happened was that, of course, there was a meeting in Madrid, and then another one in Moscow in January of 1992, bilateral negotiations between Israel and Syrians and Jordanians and Palestinians. And unfortunately, those bilaterals didn't go very far, but the multilateral talks that began actually had some significant effect. You found the rather strange experience, because in my experience it was rather strange, it hadn't happened before, of going to a meeting in Rome and finding yourself with Israelis and Saudis and maybe even someone who wasn't officially representing Syria, but somehow was a Syrian, talking to one another about normal, serious, tough problems. And during that period, we began to see a kind of legitimation of Israel in the Arab world. Diplomatic relations or quasi-diplomatic relations with Gulf states, with Tunisia, Morocco, and so on. It used to be, if you were having a meeting with Arab participants and you said there's going to be an Israeli scholar there, there would either have to be some kind of a secret meeting that nobody would ever talk about, or you would have to have some kind of special procedures to ensure that people didn't have to spend time face to face and so on. And this changed. And then we had the agreement in Oslo, the so-called Oslo Accord in 1993. Which was a great surprise to the U.S., actually. U.S. Secretary of State at that time, Warren Christopher, was told about the Oslo talks and didn't even think they were going to go anywhere. And in fact, what happened, Bill Clinton by that point was president, is basically the U.S. president catered the signing of the agreement on the White House lawn you know, he served the sandwiches with the crust cut off and all of that. And that was the site for that famous reluctant signature between Yitzhak Rabin and Yasser Arafat. Now, ultimately, that process has failed. However, the reason I'm bringing this up is that was a period of remarkable hope. Remarkable hope. In Lebanon, for example, you had a government that was making enormous investments on the premise that peace was coming. And in Palestine, you had American Palestinians returning, investing. In one case, I think opening a microbrewery, if I remember correctly. In fact, I think it was someone with a Sam Adams connection, if I'm not mistaken. And we have a Palestinian scholar, Khalil Shikaki, who is, among others, a very fine pollster. And he's been doing a lot of polling over the years. You could look at his polls longitudinally. And what you'll find from the 1990s is that as those hopes were increasing, the support for what we might describe as radical or extremist groups like Hamas declined. Hopes are up, support for Hamas 10-15%. And the opposite is true. There's a reciprocal effect. So we need to remind ourselves of that and not forget that, you know, both sides, in a sense, may really be ready for peace. Whether or not the leaders are ready for peace is something else. But given the opportunity, both sides may be ready for peace. Now, I want to fast forward to the present, and I want to imagine two things. One, I want to imagine Israel's predicament right now. And then I want to imagine what I would say to the President of the United States if I had to talk to him about U.S. interest. Why should the U.S. care about solving this conflict? So let me address Israel first. If I were an Israeli strategist, I would be very worried, actually. I'd be very worried for a number of reasons. I would be very worried because of a hardening of support for some of the most radical groups in surrounding areas and in the occupied territories. Let me give you an example. I do a lot of work in Lebanon. I've been working, in fact, Desmond Travers and I first met in South Lebanon as peacekeepers almost exactly 30 years ago, in the context of the Civil War. He was a very good companion during the Civil War, as I remember. In any case, we served together in Lebanon, and since that time, I've done a lot of work on the Shia Muslim community in Lebanon. When we were first there together, there was no Hezbollah. And in fact, the dominant force in South Lebanon was a movement called the Ahmad Movement, which was very reform-oriented and so on, and in some ways, kind of secular, not exactly, but kind of. Today, many of the people that I knew, and nowadays I often know their children, I frequently go back to Lebanon, I was there a few months ago in the south. Many of the people I knew years ago, and I'm talking here about middle class types, engineers, teachers, army officers, etc., who supported Amal are now with Hezbollah. It's not that they've become fanatically religious. In fact, many of them are not particularly religious at all. But basically, the Hezbollah narrative, which emphasizes that Israel is our enemy, and we have to be able to protect ourselves against Israel, and the threat to our existence is Israel, is very much accepted. I was very much struck by this, particularly after the war of 2006. And something similar is going on amongst Palestinians. So I would be very worried about that. I would be very worried about a decline in support from allies. Not too long ago, the Turkish government, for example, canceled a military operation with Israel. This wasn't a small event. This was a major signal. I was traveling, I'm just back from Iraq, actually. I was in Baghdad and Najaf when I was arriving in Istanbul en route to Baghdad, a leading sort of public policy intellectual and former official, Martin Indyk, was arriving in Istanbul on the same plane. And I imagine he wasn't there to have Turkish delight. Serious problem. In Turkey, public opinion is overwhelmingly in favor of the Palestinians. Public opinion overwhelmingly opposed the U.S. invasion of Iraq, and particularly after the Gaza war, is overwhelmingly with the Palestinians. So what you're seeing here is not a one-off event. And in this country, public opinion has changed. And that can be demonstrated. It's changed for a number of reasons. Television coverage of various wars, some books that have been published, Jimmy Carter's book, Peace, Not Apartheid, I think has had a tremendous impact. I think the book by my colleagues, Stephen Walt and John Mearsheimer, on the Israeli lobby, has had a big influence. We now have a counter lobby in Washington, which is much more, in my view, peace-oriented, challenging the sort of monopoly lobbying power of the American Israel Public Affairs Committee. And of course, we've had a change of administration in Washington, an administration that has a much clearer-eyed view of the conflict, in my view. So I would be concerned about that. I would be concerned about the three Ds. I would be concerned about the status of Israeli democracy and what will happen to that democracy if there isn't a peace. Because after all, there's another D problem, and that is demography. And as you know, right now the Israeli population is about 7.1 million, something like that, and with a significant minority of Palestinians, but also in the occupied territories, enough Palestinians so the projections are pointing to parity within the next decade and a half or so, or two decades. There's something very interesting in the Galilee, which in the Upper Galilee, which is the only part of Israel where you have a majority Arab population. And that's the following. If you talk to a sociologist or particularly a demographer, and you ask him the following or her the following question, what is the connection between fecundity, family size, and socioeconomic status? She would laugh and say, well, that's obvious. SES goes up, family size goes down. Particularly women's education goes up, family size goes down. It's a very robust finding. It holds up every place, almost every place in the world, except amongst Palestinians. You find middle-class Palestinians having 6, 7, 8 children. This is political copulation. This is people who are saying, we're going to have more kids, we're creating...
Somebody...
Just creating the mood or something, don't get any idea. So, these are people who are saying, we are intentionally having children because we're aware of this demographic issue. So I would be very, very concerned if I were an Israeli. I would be concerned about Iran and other strategic issues, but I would be much more concerned about bringing this conflict to an end because of the logic that Professor Cohen mentioned. And let me just run through what I think are some of the key arguments in terms of American interest here. And if I imagine myself talking to the president, first I would say, a conflict in the Arab-Israeli zone lends impetus to extremist groups within the region and globally. That's key. Israel's illegal colonization, because that's what settlement is, colonization of the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem is a major impediment to peace. Because the U.S. is Israel's firmest, most generous, and most powerful ally, it's inescapable that Israel's continuing occupation of Palestinian territories will affect Muslim and non-Muslim opinion of America. Festering conflict, undermines U.S. relations with the Muslim world, especially because Israel looks more and more like an apartheid state. Thus, the U.S. has a compelling interest in marshaling an orderly, predictable, and fair resolution of the conflict, which is to say, a resolution which emphasizes not perfect justice, but attainable justice. If the U.S. is successful in shepherding the belligerents to a peaceful settlement that meets the standards of attainable justice, then the diplomatic credibility of the U.S. will be enhanced. Without substantial progress in resolving the conflict, President Obama's eloquent Cairo speech and other U.S. overtures to Muslim opinion will appear only as empty gestures, what Arabs call kalam fadi, empty words. When I was in Najaf last week to talk to members of the Hausa, it was emphasized by several of these men who are these are the four leading, religious authorities in the Shi'i world, arguably. It was emphasized when they were talking about the U.S., they emphasized the extent to which U.S. success in resolving the Arab-Israeli conflict is a sort of measure of Obama's true sincerity. Since, and this is a point made very well by Professor Cohen, since the conflict is the main wedge to Iran for Iran to spread its influence in the Arab world, an end to the conflict would reduce Iran's opportunities for influence. And there are some other points I would make, but those are the key ones. And this means, Mr. President, let's get with it. And you've got to be clever. We have a manifest basket of nudges and signals that we can use with Israel. A lot of those who urge American activism speak about very blunt instruments. You don't have to use blunt instruments. The Israelis read U.S. signals very, very expertly. The president can hiccup, and I promise you it will be a front page story in the Israeli press. So let me give you two examples of this. One, a week before the president met Mahmoud Abbas and Bibi Netanyahu in New York at the UN General Assembly meeting, the US Navy and the Israeli Navy had a joint operation. It would have been much more interesting if, for technical reasons, that joint operation had been postponed. We're having the joint operation, it's just postponed. Another thing that the U.S. president can do, and this has been suggested as well, and that is to make himself very inaccessible to the Israeli prime minister. Because his, if you will, golden handshake is gold in the Israeli context, precisely as is being said. Personally, I do not buy the argument that Netanyahu is a peacemaker. I have colleagues who argue that he's a man of pragmatism and that he will sort of compromise everything if it's for his own survival and all of that. I don't believe that. I think this is a man with an ideological framework which has to do with the greater land of Israel and ensuring that there's no meaningful Palestinian state. And therefore, I might suggest to the president that it may not necessarily be in his interest that this particular government even survive. But that's something we would describe, we would talk about in a different context. But the president has an enormous resource. The question is, from the U.S. standpoint, is how much political capital Barack Obama is willing to spend. That's the issue. It's not that he doesn't have it, but how much is he willing to spend? And I'm not convinced he's going to be willing to spend as much as is necessary, in which case I sort of shudder at the prospect of a future without a resolution of the conflict, because I really do think we're very close to that point where the options, some of them, will disappear. Thank you very much.
My comments will be brief, hopefully useful. I do not consider myself to be an expert in this field, it's very difficulties, but I'm very, very entirely taken by the comments of my two previous colleagues with, and most of our all of the sentiments in them I am in agreement with. I just want to talk for a moment about the Goldstone report, because sometimes I think it has been misunderstood or misrepresented in some media, and then I want to make some comments, perhaps, in relation to the topic which our speakers have just addressed. The Goldstone report has taken 6 months of very, very intensive investigation and examination by my three colleagues, Professor Goldstone, Justice Goldstone, Professor Chinkin, and Ms. Hina Janani from Pakistan, Professor Chinkin from the UK, and myself from Ireland. We had a very strong committee of seven lawyers, interpreters, and investigators to support us in our efforts. And we made all our work public, and our work is available if you know the website, and you can download our meetings with witnesses and survivors, and we're here at our house. It's a very, very public exercise. And we've made our findings, and our findings have taken a variety of incidents that occurred both in southern Israel and in the territories of Gaza, and we have made those findings public, and where we have found military persons or mass persons guilty of crimes, we have said so. The reason I want to mention the question of misrepresentation is that Justice Goldstone in particular and Professor Chinkin also have been the subject of virulent attacks on their personality, their integrity, their honesty. And by extension, there's an inference that the report is unreliable. I think there have been some comments that the report is not an accurate report. So all I'm going to say about that is that this character assassination is not a critique of the report, and the character assassination has failed as far as I'm concerned, and of late, within the last 48 hours, that sort of critique in the media has seems to have quietened down. And Justice Goldstone has invited those who have criticized the report to come forward with any factual errors that are in it, or any factual findings of error that are in it, and if those are found to be true, we will reassemble and address them. So far, nobody has found any errors of fact or finding in this report. It's a very critical report. And since I handed it over and shut down my files on it on the 15th of September, it has gained momentum and it's seemingly not going away. The Court of World Opinion seems to want this report to stay. Efforts to sandbag it or bin it or put it into archives have failed completely. In fact, the one signal effort to do so has re-energized the report in a way that none of us have expected or anticipated. The report is there, it won't go away. Of late, the world's media, the reformed comment seems to suggest that perhaps the recommendations on the report, and we have made a series of recommendations because we believe in certain fundamentals, and one of the fundamentals we believe in is that there should be no impunity for crime. That we must punish or investigate all crimes equally, and as necessary, introduce the mechanisms or support the mechanisms to punish wrongdoers. That's simply our message, and that is what's giving so many people around the world so much difficulty. I think over the last 48 hours, the media tends to be accepting of the view that perhaps this option, the least worst option, is that, for example, the Hamas authorities would investigate their crimes and punish accordingly, and that the Israeli authorities would do the same. I think that is the way it should be. I think it might also produce a resolution to this dilemma of conflict in the Middle East that I have been observed on, and I will just go back a few years and talk to you about that for a minute. I observed the war in Lebanon in 2006, the Hezbollah-Israeli war. I saw Lebanon wrecked end to end the precision munitions. Oil refineries, airports, factories, food processing plants, bridges, viaducts, houses, businesses, homes, villages, towns, wrecked. I repeat that. Lebanon was wrecked, end to end. And at the end of it, on the third week of the conflict, I got to within 8 kilometers of the Israeli border, and the war was still going on, and the Israeli army had hardly advanced a kilometer. What is the end result of this? It has cost the Lebanese something in the order of $5 billion of infrastructural damage. Hezbollah's reputation has risen. They are arguably one of the most successful resistance organizations in the world. They have challenged and fought one of the finest armies in the world and fought it to a standstill, which reinforcement point we made, because they weren't there 20 years ago. And we knew them 20 years ago. So the end result of that particular military exercise is a lessening of the security on the northern Israeli border, the destruction of a neighboring country, and the rise to prominence of a virtually non-existent resistance organization of some years back. I come along to Gaza and I see the same thing. Gaza is very, very badly damaged. I understate. I am of the view that if further research is done into the condition of the Gazan environment, that it is worsening as I speak. What is the end result? Hamas's stock has risen. Don't know why, but its stock has risen. And it has risen within the Palestinian community. The Israeli military stock has risen in Israel. So what is actually happening is that the physical force option in both Israel and amongst our immediate neighbors in Gaza and in Lebanon, the physical force idea has risen, and two countries are wrecked. And in the only way to prevent this downward spiral that's recurring, there is almost a symbiotic relationship between the violence on one side of the argument and the violence on the other. The only way to address that is to have courts which will try people, make military persons and resistance people aware that there is a price to be paid, and this time it's not the civilians and the innocent that will pay it, it may well be them. And when they do that and we move the physical force option off the table, then we can probably fill the vacuum with vacuum associated with dialogue and reconciliation.